Okay, everybody, we're gonna get ourselves started. It's 8 o'clock sharp, and as you know, we start everything on time here at the Sabre Convention. Hi, I'm Scott Fishthall. Neil Traven and I are the two folks who have been coordinating these research presentations over the last few years, and we're pleased to see so many people here to get started for our first presentation of the conference. And before I get started, I just want to ask one question. Is Tara Krieger here? No, okay. So she's next, so I'm keeping my fingers crossed because I have not seen her yet. You did see her yesterday, so she is here, so okay, that's good to know. So hopefully we'll see her soon. Okay, we're going to get started today with Mark Armour. He is going to be talking about the Yankees and a lot more. Mike Burke, and here's Mark Armour. Go ahead.
Thank you for coming. Can you hear me? Yes? Okay. So I'm pinch hitting, so be kind. Dan Levitt, who I think is here, and I spent the last several years researching a book that just came out called In Pursuit of Pennants. And we profile a lot of some of the best teams in history and how their baseball operations departments adapted to the changing world and had a lot of success. And one team we talk about that had less success, didn't actually win a pennant, were the Yankees of the 1960s, or late 60s and early 70s, that were owned by CBS, which has become somewhat of a notorious period in Yankee history. They didn't win, and they won before and then won after. And I think a lot of people look back, Yankee fans in particular, look back on that era as a dark, sort of depressing period. But nonetheless, we thought there were some lessons that could be drawn that helped us tell the stories we wanted to tell in the book. So they're in there. So George Steinbrenner owned the Yankees for 37 years, won seven World Series, died in 2010. And when he died, all the obituaries, besides praising him for the success that he helped bring back to New York, also stressed the how woeful the team was that he inherited, both on and off the field. The New York Times said it was a declining Yankees team. The Washington Post said it was failing at the box office. And on the field, the Wall Street Journal called it moribund. And most of the stories had to do with the fact that he sort of picked it up from the ashes. And we found, I think what we, the story we wanted to tell essentially was it really wasn't that bad. So this year marks the 100th anniversary of the purchase of the Yankees by Jacob Rupert and Till Houston. And from that moment till today, that moment, in my opinion, is sort of when the Yankee dynasty started to get rolling. And in the 100 years since then, they've won 40 pennants and 27 World Series. And during much of that time, they had significant advantages over most of the other teams. Once Rupert got there, Rupert had a lot of money, and he also was willing to spend it on the team, which is a key second ingredient. And that, for most of the century, the Yankees have had the advantage of resources, not necessarily over every team, but over most of the teams. Resources, prestige, once they started winning, they could go into kids' houses and say, how'd you like to play for the Yankees? And most kids grew up as Yankee fans, and they had an advantage signing people. They had absolutely incredibly competent management. All that time, and especially under Rupert and Steinbrenner, which is the majority of that century, they had an incredible desire to win and would do virtually anything to do so, which is a pretty lethal combination of advantages. So the one period in their history when these advantages meant the least was between 1965, when the amateur draft came in, and 1976 when free agency came in. That was a period of time when the Yankees' money and prestige meant virtually nothing. They couldn't use that advantage to buy amateurs. They couldn't use that advantage to buy professionals. There were no teams going bankrupt that they could buy players from. Their method of operation was the same as everyone else's. They had to wait for the June draft. They had to pick players one by one. They had to make trades. They had to develop players. And money, while not nothing, wasn't quite as important as it was before, especially before and after. So the early 1960s, before CBS bought the team, had, for the Yankees, a lot of instability off the field, and a lot of changes in the front office. Casey Stengel and George Weiss had run the team on and off the field for more than a decade, and they were fired after the 1960 World Series. The next year, the team was run by Dan Topping, who was had been the president for the previous 14 years and remained the president. Roy Hamey, who was the GM, Ralph Houk was the manager, and they were the champions in 1961. The next year, the same management team came back, and they were the champions again. 1963, same management team, and they won the pennant, and they lost in the World Series. After the 63 season, Roy Hamey, who had been in baseball for many years with the Yankees and other teams, retired, and Ralph Houk, who had been the manager, became the general manager, and they hired Yogi Berra to manage the team, and they won the pennant again. So things are going pretty well. And after the 64 season, Berra was fired by Houk, and I'm not getting all of the slide here. Sorry, there's some of the slide that's falling off the end. I'm not sure why that is. So in late 1964, the Yankees were bought by CBS. The sale was announced in August, finalized in November. And they replaced Berra with Johnny Keene, and the next year they finished in sixth place. So that's the fall. And the question at the time was, how could such a thing happen? This is the Yankees, and the Yankees always win or contend. And a lot of theories have been expressed or have been mentioned over the years. The first of which is that it was CBS's fault. CBS bought the team in the fall, they collapsed in the summer. But really, that was too soon. It was too soon to blame a change of ownership. Management didn't change. It was the same people running the team. Another theory is that the Yankees didn't stop developing players and were all sort of caught up with them at that time. To some extent, that's always a possibility. The 1964 Yankees, though, had Jim Bowden and Mel Stottlemyre and Al Downing, three really young pitchers. Tom Tresh was a star. Joe Pepitone was a star. These guys were all 25 or younger. It's probably as good a core of young players as any team in baseball had. They didn't develop as a group as much as maybe one would have thought at the end of that season. But nonetheless, I think it's hard to blame that exactly. Jerry Coleman, who was an announcer for the team, blamed later the fact that it was basically a frat house, that there was degenerate behavior off the field led by Mantle and some of the other stars, and this affected both the players like Pepitone and Bowden, of course, wrote about it, how crazy it all was, but also some of the young players that were coming up. Steve Whitaker later wrote or later told Jane Levy that he was one of the many next Mickey Mantles, and he talked about how he spent every night as a rookie drinking with Mickey Mantle, his idol. And although he doesn't regret that, he does. He did say that this probably in retrospect was not the right way to go about it. So you never know. That's possible. People blame Johnny Keene. And it was clear that Keane had come over from the Cardinals, and that was a much different kind of team in terms of its behavior. And it does seem like Keane didn't really know how to deal with these people that were used to doing a lot of late nights and partying, and I don't think they gave him the respect that the Cardinals had. Injuries and age, that's the reason why most teams fall, right? And certainly the Yankees had their share. Mantle was hurt after 64 most of the time. Maris got hurt. Richardson, Kubek got hurt. Bowden, of course, never really was the same. Ford and Elston Howard especially got old pretty quickly. But the biggest lesson, I think, of the Yankees is that why not? Why shouldn't they? I mean, everyone else has these down periods, and what happened to the Yankees should illustrate or should point out not what was amazing about the collapse, but was the fact that they had not had a bad year in 40 years. That was the more amazing thing. So after the 1965 season, Ralph Houk, who was the general manager, and did very little during his time as general manager, traded for Ruben Amaro. And I mention that because that's all he did. And so he believed, and I think the Yankees hierarchy believed, that all these guys who had been injured were just going to get better again. And Mantle and Ford and Howard would just return to their old selves and everything would keep on clicking. And that didn't happen, actually. So in 1966, the Yankees started the season 4-16. And then they fired Keane, replaced him with Houk. So Houk is in the as general manager. He goes back to the dugout. They replace Houk with Dan Topping Jr. Dan Topping Sr. had always wanted his son to get more involved. He'd been in the front office for a while. He was 28 or something at this time. And a lot of people think that's the reason why they got rid of Weiss, is that so that Dan Topping Jr. would eventually take over in that position. But anyway, they finished last. Didn't come together. In September of 1966, basically at the end of the season, Topping Sr., who he and Del Webb both maintained 10% of the team, they sold out, or Webb had already, Topping sold out and quit, and CBS, who was running the team in a pretty hands-off way, hired Mike Burke to be president, to run the team off the field, and that's most of what we're talking about, is what is the change that happened when Mike Burke took over. So I think it's fair to say that no one like Mike Burke has ever run a baseball team before or since. He was a star halfback at Penn before the war. He later tried out for the Philadelphia Eagles. He was a decorated OSS officer who parachuted behind German lines in late 1944. He was highly decorated. When he reached Paris, he drank with Ernest Hemingway and they became lifelong friends. He later worked for the CIA in Berlin. He ran the Barnum Bailey Circus for a few years. He later became president of CBS Europe. When CBS bought the Yankees in 64, they made Burke essentially a liaison to the team. This is the time, CBS was a massive corporation. CBS Television was one of seven divisions of the company, and they were diversifying at that time, and not in a sense of trying to control these other things, but really just help with branding. That's why they bought the Yankees. So Burke's first move as head of the Yankees was to fire Red Barber, which there's every indication that was not his decision. That decision was made before he got there, but he did defend it. And Barber never forgave him. His second move was better. He hired Lee McPhail as general manager. And these three guys, Burke, McPhail, and Houk, ran the Yankees for the next 7 years. McPhail had run the Yankee farm system in the 50s, which was obviously a highly impressive farm system, and then became the GM of the Orioles. He was there for 8 years and really built the team that won the World Series in 1966. He was one of the most respected general managers in the game at that time. So the two main problems with the Yankees, for the most part, Burke handled the team, the business, McPhail, the roster. McPhail's problem was they didn't have any talent. Burke's problem was that nobody liked them. They were pretty unpopular, and they got to work. So it's hard to stress how unpopular the Yankees had become in New York. They were unpopular, really unpopular, when they were winning in the early 60s, and they became much more unpopular once they started to lose. They had they sort of ran the team like a sort of a cold corporate operation. They didn't really have any attempt to cater to the fans, and the media always called them on it. They mocked the Mets for being so sort of team friendly, friendly to the fans, and people ended up going to Mets games. So, not showing up, okay. So the Mets first outdrew the Yankees in 1964, which was the year Shea Stadium opened. The Yankees won the pennant and the Mets were horrible. And the Mets remained ahead of the Yankees in attendance until 1976 when the Yankee Stadium was remodeled. Most of that was because of the way the Mets treated their fans, I think. So, Burke knew that this was a problem and began working on it right away. He started to stage more days. He moved the team offices back into the stadium. They'd been in Manhattan for many years. He gave the press his home phone number. He went to dinner with the press all the time. He held lots of days for civic groups. He brought the team into the city to talk to kids, which is something they hadn't really done before. He had the stadium repainted. He hired usherettes, which apparently was pretty popular. He had banner days, which the Yankees had criticized the Mets for having, beginning in 1967. He wrote inspirational messages in the yearbook every year. He really owned up to the fact that nobody liked the team, and I think he was pretty straightforward about wanting to change that. Rather than having political dignitaries throughout the first pitch, he hired people that he kind of admired and respected. This is the poet Marianne Moore throughout the first pitch in one of his early years. This is Whitney Young, who was the head of the Urban League. In 1972, the guy who threw out the first pitch was somebody who lived in the same hotel as Burke and ran into him in the lobby and asked him if he could throw out the first pitch, so he threw out the first pitch opening day. So this is what George Vesey said about Burke, that he should be in the Hall of Fame because he made people actually like the Yankees again. So the most important thing Burke did in terms of the long-term Yankee story is that he made a deal with John Lindsay, that's Lindsay in the middle, to remodel the stadium. And initially they had a plan which was cost $24 million, which is what Shea Stadium cost to build. And that was the idea, was like he spent $24 million on the Mets, spent $24 million on us. And although it seems unthinkable now, there was every possibility that the Yankees were gonna leave. New Jersey was luring all the New York teams at that time, and they got the Giants. They had the Giants by then, and they didn't leave. And later, when the park reopened several years later, it was hailed as the park that Burke rebuilt. He got a lot of credit for saving the Yankees for New York. So this is the two best players that McPhail inherited were Pepitone and Tom Tresh. And in retrospect, he probably should have traded both of them because they were through. But he didn't know that, so he kept them. And they also had some young talent on the team. They had Sotomayor and Peterson. They had Bauman and Downing. Bauman was through. Downing was somewhat inconsistent, but the first two guys had good years. And they had White and Clark, who were young and really became better players under this regime, and Bonson and Mercer. Mercer had to go into the military right after right after McPhail took over. But within a couple of years, he was, you know, one of the best players in the American League. In the first draft that McPhail oversaw, the Yankees had the first pick, and they picked Lon Bloomberg, which McPhail later owned up as a mistake. He thought Bloomberg didn't work hard enough. But in subsequent years, they did much better in the draft. They got Munson and Doc Medich and Guidry and Scott McGregor. This is all in a four-year period. So I think they did pretty well there. By 1968, they were over 500, which means that the Yankees' really bad years only lasted 3 years. And they were, while not necessarily competitive with a team as good as the Orioles, they were at least non-bad for the rest of the CBS years. And many of these guys that are pictured here, especially White and Mercer and Sotomayor, were really good players at that time. So McPhail's biggest year, like Burke, was probably 1972. He made his two best trades, one with the Red Sox to get Sparky Lyle. I don't want to talk about that. But he also got Greg Nettles at the end of the season from the Indians for four prospects. And what's interesting about that is because when he took over the team, he didn't have any prospects to trade, really. But he did trade four guys for Nettles. Charlie Spikes was one of the best prospects in the game, and that landed him Nettles. Going into the 73 season, the Yankees were odds-on favorites to win the American League East. They were considered one of the best teams in baseball. But before that happens, CBS asked Mike Burke to sell the team. He sold it to Steinbrenner with the understanding that Burke would run the team off the field, and Burke actually maintained, he was one of the limited partners of the team. And that didn't really work out. Within a few months, Burke was gone. He realized he was going to have nothing to do, and Steinbrenner took over. So Gabe Paul then became the GM and built that great team. And I just wanted to point out that Gabe Paul inherited a much better collection of talent than McPhail had, that the Yankees talent-wise were in pretty good shape by the time he got there. And what Steinbrenner inherited was a stadium about to come back in 1976. And once they opened the stadium again, they took New York back over, and except for the 80s, have kept it. So that is my talk. Thank you very much. Rod.
Yeah, what was the valuation of the team over CBS? What did they buy
it
for?
CBS sold it at a loss. I think they bought it for $12 million and sold it for $10.
Yeah, I think it's unfair to blame any new management for what happens the first few years they're in. And I wonder if a lot of those steps go back to policies in the early years, even in the late 50s. I remember vividly in the autobiography Charlie Ostrowski did after 1967, he told the story of how he did not become a Yankee because they would not bid nearly as much money as the Red Sox and several other teams, because they seemed to feel that he should be so happy to fight for the Yankees, particularly being from Long Island, that he should accept half the money. And that was only one story, but obviously the Yankees had had Carl Ostrowski for the whole 1960s. A lot of the story would have been different, and presumably there were parallel decisions with other people as well.
Right, and I think that's true. I think that the Yankees, I think if you looked at the Yankees, the people the Yankees developed, that the in my opinion, the players they developed in the 1960s were just as good or maybe even better than the players that were being developed in the 50s once the Mantle, Ford, McDougal class came up. I think the late 50s, they were developing players that were no better than anybody else's, and guys like White, Mercer, Munson, they would have fit in really well with those dynasty teams, but they didn't have Mantle and Barron Ford. So yeah, that could be. Anybody else? I apologize, I can't see out of one eye, so.
Yeah,
If you're raising your hand, I don't know. Bob?
You didn't mention the Kansas City A's. What's your take on the role of the A's and when that period ended, how that might have affected the Yankees?
We can't hear the question in the back.
He asked about whether the Kansas City A's relationship played a role in the 1950s Yankees. And I think that's somewhat been overrated, but I haven't, you know, whether I go through it, you know, person by person, I don't know. But I think that the other takeaway is that I think Dan and I agree on this, that the American League of the 1950s was one of the weakest leagues in Major League history. The National League was far superior. The Yankees really didn't have a lot of competition. They had three teams that were essentially had no chance at all. The Red Sox were poorly run. The Tigers were in the toilet. There's really just Cleveland and Chicago, but there were several teams in the National League better than that. So a problem the Yankees had was that in the 60s, a lot of the American League teams woke up. The Red Sox woke up, the Tigers, the Orioles, and they didn't have that kind of team. George Weiss never had to compete against a team as good as the 69, 70, 71 Orioles. So that's part of it. They're not in a vacuum.
Thanks, Mark. We're out of time. We appreciate it.
All right.